Chief Justice Steele, Justice Holland, Justice Ridgely, may it please the court. Good morning. My name is Stephen Welsh. I'm here on behalf of Appellant Elmer Dobson. Mr. Dobson was convicted on September 12, 2012, of 6 counts of rape in the second degree and 1 count of endangering the welfare of a child. By way of brief recitation of the facts, Mr. Dobson was involved in a relationship with CC, the mother of the complaining witness, BC. Said relationship lasted from 2006 until about June of 2011. In the fall of 2011, BC, the complaining witness, a minor, made allegations that Mr. Dobson had been allegedly inappropriately touching BC over a one-year time span approximately from August 2010 to August 2011. Said touches allegedly were 6 separate incidences of digital penetration that took place 2 times in BC's bedroom, 2 times in the living room, allegedly 1 time in CC, BC's mother's room, and allegedly 1 time in the bathroom in the residence. At the time of trial, BC testified not to these 6 separate distinct instances, but to 8 instances, including an additional incident that allegedly took place in BC's mother's room, as well as an additional incident that took place in the bathroom.
Now, when this happened, what was defense counsel's reaction?
Your Honor, I wasn't defense counsel at the time. I was substitute counsel, but there was no objection.
What was the theory for defense counsel taking the position that defense counsel took at the time?
Your Honor, it's not clear from the record. The best that I can tell, the indictment, when it was presented and unamended before going to trial, included 6 counts of rape in the second degree. Prior to the end of the state's case, there was no demarcation as to which alleged offense went with which count of the indictment. The best that I can tell from going back through the record, defense counsel didn't know which alleged incidents went with which count of the indictment.
Well, what is troubling me, just to be totally upfront about it, is when we're looking at situations where there's a question raised about the level of confidence in the outcome because of a Getz issue or prior bad acts or however you want to characterize it, I looked at what defense counsel did or didn't do and try to and wonder whether with hindsight are we questioning defense tactics here or are we to focus on what actually went allegedly wrong. And with that said, did defense counsel file a bill of particulars?
No, Your Honor.
Move to strike the indictment for vagueness?
No, Your Honor.
So where does that leave us?
Leaves us trying to interpret the record to determine whether this was a tactical decision or whether it was plain error.
Okay, you've got it. Tell me then. That's yes, where I was headed.
Yes, Your Honor.
Before you start your answer, it's my understanding that the original attorney for this defendant filed a Rule 26C brief and was let out of the case.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And that this court appointed you because it thought there were arguable issues. So
correct, Your Honor.
That's what you're briefing and arguing.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so let's see what they are.
Yes, Your Honor. The defendant believes there's plain error based on the fact that under a Getz analysis, the prior bad acts clearly wouldn't have come in. It seems like the state's argument.
Now, why is it that they would not have come in? Because there were more counts here than the 6 rape counts. There was also endangering the welfare of a child.
Correct, Your Honor. There was the additional count of endangering the welfare of the child.
With these, granted, it's certainly more serious than perhaps a typical endangering the welfare of a child allegation, but don't these other 2 instances satisfy that statute?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, and it gets more into my second argument than my first argument, but the reason I don't believe it satisfies is because the jury was never instructed as to which alleged incident that took place in mother's room or which alleged incident that took place in the bathroom was part of the indictment. So it's not clear what the jury actually convicted Mr. Dobson on for which alleged incident in the bathroom and which alleged incident in mother's room. And so it's not thereby clear if the jury did convict for endangering the welfare of the child based on these other incidents, which incident it was, if it was one of these incidents, or if half the jury was looking at incident 1 in the bathroom and half the jury was looking at incident two in the bedroom and using that to convict for endangering the welfare of the child.
Well, isn't it fair to say even if those other two incidents, for lack of a better way to refer to them, somehow were relevant to endangering the welfare of a child, the problem still remains that the jury may infer from those two incidents that it's likely that the six for which he was indicted occurred because there's evidence of the other two. And that's exactly what Getz is trying to address. Lay inference where juries can't parse without at least a cautionary instruction how they're supposed to use the evidence that they hear in order to resolve the question of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt on a specific crime.
Exactly, Your Honor.
And I take it defense counsel didn't ask for a cautionary instruction.
No, Your Honor.
Is there an explanation for that?
Not that I can find in the record, Your Honor.
Is it tactical or stupidity? Which?
Your Honor, it potentially could go both ways. It's easy for me to stand here and say, looking back at the record, that I would have done things differently.
Give me the tactical reason, if there is one.
The potential tactical reason that what I anticipate the state would argue, and which to a degree makes sense, is that this whole case goes off of the complaining witness. And the only way really to win this case is to show that the complaining witness is not credible. So part of that tactic could be to allow these additional incidents in to then cross-examine later on and show that an original statement that was made in the CAC only included this many incidents. Now you're in trial claiming that there's eight incidents, and obviously that this witness has been tampered with by mother or that she's not reliable or doesn't remember. I believe that's what the state's going to argue. The problem with inferring that intention of defense counsel is I don't believe it's bore out by the record.
Let me ask you whether this does it, because didn't defense counsel say regarding the CAC interview that he wanted to play the tape in order to show, quote, the vast differences in what she told Mr. Richardson and what she testified to in this court? And that's it. B9.1, I think.
Yes, Your Honor, and the state brings that up, and I think rightfully so, in their answering brief. The key to that, though, is it looks very bad. It looks like that's clear what the intent is for defense counsel at that point. But if you actually look at the cross-examination was not focused on six alleged instances in the CAC and now eight alleged instances. What the cross-examination was focused on was the timing of when this was reported, the timing of who was in the house at the time, the timing of answers that were given to the complaining witness's school teacher as opposed to then giving in the CAC. And defense counsel focuses on that additionally in closing. And I think that's very telling. Defense counsel doesn't say in closing, you know, there were eight counts, the eight alleged instances that you testified to today and six instances in the CAC. They focus on the fact that at the time of the CAC wasn't really clear. There was apparently three instances at the time of the CAC, one with actual digital penetration. Now the story has changed. There's not that distinct focus on six versus eight that you would think would be there if the theory behind allowing this in was a defense tactical strategy.
And even if that was the defense tactical strategy, isn't it fair to say that the defense counsel should have attempted to have it both ways? Have it come in, but have a cautionary instruction so the jury didn't get confused and step into the Getz trap of inferring from the other two incidents, well, if there are eight, the six must be true.
Yes, Your Honor. You would think that defense counsel would have brought this up, if at only to clarify for the jury instruction and for the verdict form. And that, once again, that goes more to my second argument than my first argument. But if it was a tactic, even if that was the thought process here, that we're going to allow this in to show the complaining witness just doesn't have credibility, at least, at the very least, you would think with the verdict form they would clarify as to which actual incidents the jury was being asked to find Mr. Dobson guilty of. What incident in the bedroom? What incident in the bathroom? And that wasn't done here. So that leads me to believe, based on the review of the record, that it wasn't a tactical decision, that it was simply an oversight based on the fact that there wasn't really any clarification in the indictment from the start as to which incidents corresponded with which alleged occurrence, and simply defense counsel missed it, for lack of a better explanation.
So why isn't that raised by a Rule 61 where defense counsel can respond to the allegation?
Well, Your Honor, I think it can be raised in both. Should it be raised in a Rule 61? Yes, probably. But in addition, this court in Williams v. State conducted a Goetz analysis despite the fact that trial counsel did not object. And that's what we're asking the court to do today, is to look at it in a view of plain error, whether this made the trial inherently unfair and prejudiced the jury because we have these additional counts that were brought in that under just a strictly Goetz analysis should not have come in.
So help me understand the plain error analysis. What was the plain error by the trial judge?
Yes, Your Honor. And with a light to the fact that it probably should have been objected to. The error of the trial judge was two parts, in my opinion, goes to both my first argument and my second argument. Firstly, the prior bad acts or the subsequent bad acts, the additional alleged occurrences, should never have come into evidence and gone before the jury. They weren't charged. They weren't alleged. It shouldn't have been allowed to go to the jury. And once there was testimony of 8 alleged occurrences as opposed to 6 alleged occurrences, I believe there should have been, obviously there should have been an objection. There should have been a request for a mistrial at that point because the jury had heard evidence that they shouldn't have heard.
But did that error affect all the charges or only 2?
I would think it would have affected all the charges. It's impossible to tell exactly how it affected the jury, but to hear additional evidence that shouldn't have been before the jury, it had to have affected the jury in that they can, at that point, assume a tendency for Mr. Dobson to do this. And who knows how many other times he's done it. They're hearing additional alleged incidences that haven't been charged. And I think that's the exact purpose of having a Goetz analysis in the first place, and the exact purpose for 404B, because we do allow those prior bad acts with some limited exceptions, but this doesn't fit any of those limited exceptions.
There is the inconvenience of those other 2 occurrences never having been presented to a grand jury.
Correct, Your Honor.
Unless they somehow qualify under the endangering the welfare of a child.
Right? Yes, Your Honor. And once again, defense's argument as to whether that qualified under endangering the welfare of the child, if that were the case, then we also believe it was plain error by the court not to clarify that for the jury in the jury verdict form or in the jury instructions. The jury instructions included clarification as to the first 6 counts. The first 6 counts corresponded with the complaining witness's bedroom for counts 1 and 2, the living room for counts 3 and 4, mother's room for count 5, and the bathroom for count 6. Endangering the welfare of a child, there was no further clarification if that corresponded to the other incident in mother's bedroom or the other alleged incident in the bathroom. So the jury was free, essentially at that point, to pick and choose what incident would correspond with what. And to this day, it's not clear what the jury actually convicted of for counts 5 and count 6, and additionally count 7. If they convicted of, if all 12 agreed that Mr. Dobson was guilty of count, or the first alleged instance in mother's room, or was it the second alleged incident in mother room where 6 of the jurors did for the first and 6 for the second? It's just not clear based on the verdict.
Do we have to know what the jury thought, or is there sufficient evidence to sustain a conviction of those counts?
Well, I think we run into some serious double jeopardy issues potentially if we don't know what the juror actually convicted Mr. Dobson of, what act he was actually convicted of. And I think that's the case here because there's not clarification because there was 4 separate occurrences testified to and only 2 or potentially 3 if you include the endangering the welfare of the child count, only 3 counts to convict of. So it's not clear which corresponded with which alleged occurrence.
Clarify for me, if the other 2 instances we've been referring to correspond in terms of elements of a crime with 6, with the 6 for which he was convicted, what is the evidentiary basis for the separate endangering the welfare of a child charge?
I don't think there is one, Your Honor. I don't think there's a separate evidentiary basis unless, I guess potentially there could have been a lesser included in the jury instruction, but that wasn't done here. It was actually a separate charge, not charged as a lesser included.
Well, if there were the 6 counts, no mention of 2 other instances, what would have been the basis for the conviction for endangering the welfare of a child? The fact that he was guilty of the 6 other incidents?
I guess.
How is it a separate and distinct offense?
I don't believe it is, Your Honor. And that probably should have been raised on direct appeal, but it wasn't. But I agree with Your Honor. I don't believe that there is a separate offense within the evidence presented to sustain the endangering of the
whereabouts. To be fair, I'm not sure you're agreeing with someone who knows what he's saying right now. I haven't figured it out yet myself. At least I don't think I have. I'm trying to get help, and I'm sure I'll get help from Ms. McFarland as well. But that troubles me. I'm not getting closure on that issue.
Yes, Your Honor. And I understand the question. I think that goes directly to defendant's point that I don't think you can use the endangering the welfare of the child then to just say that, okay, these other unindicted charges, well, we could have allowed those in under the umbrella of endangering the welfare of the child.
Well, if offenses are being double counted, isn't the remedy merger at sentencing?
Yes, Your Honor. As far as for the double counting, that would go to my second point as opposed to my first point. The double counting issue, I think the remedy would be that counts 5 and 6 should be reversed because it's not clear what the actual conviction was for counts 5 and 6.
All right. You're close to your rebuttal time. Do you want to go on or save it?
I'd like to save my rebuttal time, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Elizabeth McFarland on behalf of the state. Most of the issues, if not all of the issues in this case, could have been resolved had defense counsel simply moved for a bill of particulars. The problem that arose are really based on the fact that prior to the evidence coming in, neither the defense counsel nor the judge apparently knew, and it's not clear that the prosecutor knew which incidents went to what charge in the indictment. Had the defense counsel asked for that ahead of time, the bill of particulars would have clarified it, and it would have allowed the court to make decisions as to whether extraneous information was coming in or limiting instructions or whatever.
Well, that's interesting. Who is responsible for producing an indictment that's specific enough to put a defendant on notice of what he's charged?
The burden of notice is a broad burden on the state to give the defendant notice, general notice of the charges to which he must answer. This had a time frame, it had a victim, it had the type of incident that occurred. At that point, the burden shifts to the defendant to request a bill of particulars if that is unclear to him what particular incidents within that he is charged with.
Well, let's just look at this record and pretend there was a motion for a judgment of acquittal on the endangering charge. What would the state have said to the judge that it had introduced this evidence to prove endangering?
The endangering would have been the exposure to the acts of digital penetration.
All 8?
The state would have said that, yes.
And what would be the basis for arguing that if it proved the 6 major charges in the indictment, they didn't subsume the endangering? Why is endangering still a standalone offense?
Because endangering includes an additional element. The state went to great lengths to prove that the defendant was a caretaker, someone who had the who looked after the children, that it was his responsibility to care for the welfare of the children.
But there was 1 count of endangering.
That is correct.
And there were 6 counts, 6 other counts.
That is correct.
Why weren't there 6 counts of endangering?
Because the idea of the endangering charge is that by exposing a child to this continuous type of activity, when you are in charge of the welfare of that child, would be endangering the welfare of the child.
So you committed 6 separate crimes, but you only endangered the child once.
Well, I think you endangered the child's welfare overall. it could, another way of charging it would have been to charge continuous sexual abuse of a child. Would probably have been a clearer charge. That's the most often, that's the charge that would be with the other counts. The state's position is that the...
Help me understand, if a bill of particulars had been filed, what would it have said as to the counts that the jury heard?
It would have not included the two counts in the bathroom. The CAC tape, which was the basis for the charges, did not include any reference to anything in the bathroom. So the state would not have included that. If there had been a bill of particulars prior to trial, there was no evidence.
Did that just pop up by surprise at trial, with the prosecutor not knowing about it?
That was unclear to me. I tried to discern that from the record. There certainly was nothing. I listened to the CAC tape. There was nothing in there.
I assume the prosecutor, at least who drafted the indictment, didn't know about those other two accusations, or they would have been in the indictment.
That was my assumption as well, Your Honor. When they came up at trial, the questioning made me wonder whether there was some knowledge. But there's nothing that I could find to... The only possibility would have been normally that it would be the practice to interview the child one time by the prosecutor prior to trial, usually about a week ahead of trial. Prosecutor will meet with a victim. The only thing the state can discern from the record is it's a possibility that the prosecutor knew that a week ahead of time, because there were direct questions asked. There was a question asked on direct about the bathroom, which leads me to believe that the prosecutor must have had some inkling. But it certainly was nowhere on the CAC tape. So presumably, if a bill of particulars had been requested, it would have been more prior to that interview with the child, if that was the case.
Let me make sure I understand your last comment. The additional two incidences were triggered by the prosecutor asking a question about events in the bathroom, which were limited to the two unindicted occurrences. Is that correct?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Is that troublesome?
Unless they all knew about it ahead of time. There was no objection, and it can go to the endangering, but the... there was nothing that was done about it at the time when it was asked. There was no objection. There was no...
No, I know there was no objection, but what I'm trying to get straight in my head is, if the prosecutor specifically asked about the bathroom, at least an inference that they knew there would be some response that would suggest there was an occurrence in the bathroom, the prosecutor had to know that wasn't mentioned in the indictment. And if the prosecutor had advance notice of that, you would think, in order to protect the record, the prosecutor would say to the court, I want, as a proffer, to say there are two other instances that I believe relate to the endangering the welfare of a child count and not the other six, but let's sort this out so we don't have issues about the propriety of asking this question. But that never occurred.
There was also the issue of the Florida incident, which was brought up at trial, which there was no objection to, and clearly defense counsel knew that could not possibly have been related to a charge, as it did not occur in Delaware.
Who brought that up?
That was brought up, I believe the prosecutor asked the Mr. Richardson, did you ever ask the victim about Florida? I have no good explanation for that. And then defense counsel, on cross-examination, immediately asked, this was going on, did you ask her any questions about the bathroom? Did you ask her anything about Florida? So rather than asking for an objecting and asking for a limiting or cautionary instruction, defense counsel went on and added to it, which leads me to conclude that defense counsel had a clear strategy. And that strategy included contrasting what was being said at this point with the CAC tape.
But the argument we're hearing from the other side is that these other bad acts should have been controlled by a Getz analysis, and that what we really have here are the charged incidents and then the prosecutor talking about other uncharged incidents, leaving the jury with the impression that this was something ongoing and not even limited to these charges. And that's why in this appeal we're hearing it's plain error.
Well, the judge did not know at the time which charges related to which counts. The judge had no more information on that than anyone else. So it would be difficult for the court to know when something was coming in that wasn't necessarily going to the charge other than Florida. But
yeah, well, that is inconvenient, isn't it? I think the judge would probably realize that he would be indicted for something that occurred out of our jurisdiction.
Now, the CAC tape, which defense counsel clearly wanted the jury to hear, was also tended to make it sound like there were more incidents than were being charged as well. This was a special ed victim. The CAC tape was, there were lots of references to this. He usually did this, or lots of times, but when asked whether how many times, the victim consistently would either say it didn't happen once or two times, no matter what, it was two times, which when you would watch the CAC tape, it became clear that that was also not necessarily the limit to it. So that evidence that it was happening more than that, I think, was reasonably inferred just from the CAC tape as well, that defense clearly wanted in. It was not this happened once, this happened twice, this happened.
Tell us why there's no plain error for failing to address the Getz issue or giving a cautionary instruction.
Because there was, as I said, the court was not in a position to know what evidence, as it came in, related to which charge. And therefore, without objection from defense counsel, the court was left in a position of not interfering with the strategy of the defense. And
well, what's a case doesn't come to mind, maybe my mind, maybe one comes to your mind, where the evidence is presented relating to multiple incidents that are more than six, but there are only six charges. Then after this shotgun approach to multiple incidents comes in, the evidence closes, and the court says, well, these are the six that we really can relate to the indictment. I realize maybe everybody asks for a bill of particulars, and that's why nothing comes to my mind, but is this a practice you've ever seen in any case where there's testimony about more incidents than charged in the indictment, and then you winnow it down after the evidence closes?
There are, I'm thinking of cases where there were certainly more incidents that came in than the charged. The ones I can think of all had a continuous abuse charge along with them, and in my recollection, they've almost all had, I can't think of one where there wasn't a bill of particulars. To do that, and normally there's no objection to the additional.
But if you had a bill of particulars, you'd talk about six. You wouldn't be talking about ten.
Arguably, they would go to the endangering. Yes, you could still talk about.
But you would know that.
Yes.
Now, how can they go to the endangering without a cautionary instruction so the jury would understand how to sort out the relevance of the unindicted incidences for the actual digital penetration as opposed to the argument that this is a custodial situation that gives rise to a pattern of conduct that constitutes endangering the welfare of a child? How does the jury intuit that?
Well, I think because the jury could use the indicted as well as the unindicted, that they all go to the endangering, so in that sense they aren't being left with...
I understand your argument about the additional element in the endangering and that the six indicted charges could relate to that. I follow that. I follow how if a jury was instructed how to use the other two unindicted occurrences or incidents for the purpose of determining the endangering of the welfare, I can understand that. But what I'm having difficulty with is here the jury was never instructed that that was the proper way and that they should not use the unindicted instances as inferable instances that the other six for which he was indicted actually occurred. You follow me?
I do.
I didn't state it very well.
I understand what you're saying. I think that they were given the usual instructions about how you have to find each element of the crime and the offense.
No, I understand that, but Getz plays a role here, doesn't it? Whether it's prior or subsequent, to use those stilted legalese terms, bad acts, whether they're before or after the six for which he was indicted, isn't there still the danger here the jury's going to infer guilt from the multiplicity of incidences, including the uncharged acts?
I believe that a limiting instruction would have been appropriate here. However, in light of the six counts versus eight counts, the state doesn't see that it would be overly prejudicial in this particular case.
Overly, just prejudicial, not overly prejudicial.
All the state's evidence is prejudicial to the defendant. So at least that's the state's objective.
Unfairly prejudicial.
Unfairly. It's not unfairly prejudicial in this case because I don't think the jury is going to take a leap between six and eight counts.
So do I understand the state's position to be kind of building on the part of the record Justice Ridgely read, that the defense strategy was to let in all of these many incidents to show they demonstrated inconsistencies that undermine the credibility of the complainant? And to the extent the record suggests that strategic decision, if there are other problems, they should be addressed in a Rule 61 motion where a record could be developed, but not for plain error in a direct appeal.
Yes, that would be the state's position. And that any error on the part of the court in not sua sponte giving a limiting instruction would be harmless in this case.
But did the trial judge make a error, and then I'd like to discuss whether it's plain or not, in referring to counts 5 and 6 without specifying which incident corresponded with each?
The court allowed the prosecutor to choose the incident that went with each count in the indictment. And on 5, the prosecutor chose a location. And there had been 2 incidents in that location. In closing, the prosecutor only argued about 1 incident. Count 6, the state concedes, is a problem because not only was count 6 specified as bathroom, the state argued 2 versions in closing. And that is problematic because then there was no specific unanimity instruction to count 6, and the state at this point concedes that count 6 should go. Count 5, only 1 version was argued, and the evidence that was argued was in front of the jury. And it also related back to the CAC tape. So I think that that count could still stand. That's the state's position on counts 5 and 6.
Thank you very much.
Did you want anything regarding the argument 3?
Not if you don't want to talk about it.
I have just a moment. I would just like to say that the courts did not preclude cross-examination about DFS or the alleged allegation about the victim's mom. And in fact, at the end of the trial, the court specifically went back to defense counsel and asked defense counsel, I want to be clear, you know, I didn't prevent you from introducing testimony, you just hadn't linked it up at that point. And defense counsel said, me, my client, and my other wizards, to determine the best course. He said wizards, I'm not sure who that is. And that was decided. So he made a strategic choice not to go down that road in terms of arguing the DFS complaint, unsubstantiated complaint.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just briefly in rebuttal, if I understand the state's position as they put forth today, that prior to trial, counsel wasn't aware, or at least directly prior to trial, wasn't aware about the incidents that took place in the bathroom. What becomes even more concerning about that is what the prosecutor in this case indicated for count 6, not that count 5 and count 6 are the bedroom, as I believe now, according to the state's position, was the intention and what Mr. Dobson was indicted on, these 6 alleged instances. But instead of using the bedroom for count 6, the prosecutor then set forth that one of the instances in the bathroom, while not determining which incident it would be count 6 of the indictment. So I think it makes it even more unclear as to what was being presented to the jury. What was the jury supposed to find as far as these 6 counts? Which of them had been indicted counts and which of them were not?
Well, you heard what the state said about count 6.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that does remedy part of the issue. But I think it goes...
Well, what's the part that's not remedied?
Well, the state's conceding that count 6 wasn't clear. And my understanding of their concession basically is that count 6 should be thrown out because it's not clear what Mr. Dobson was convicted of. That doesn't get to the larger issue of against analysis.
As I understood the state's position, there was no specific unanimity instruction on count 6, with 2 different instances being argued to support the conviction. And in the absence of that, that count has to be set aside.
Yes, Your Honor. But I still don't believe that remedies the overall gets issue of these unindicted instances being allowed to go before the jury. It remedies the limited issue in my second argument, and I would argue that while the state is conceding count 6, I believe it also would go to count 5. The fact that the prosecutor in her closing specified as to one alleged incident as opposed to another, I don't necessarily know that can clarify to the jury of all the evidence they heard previously about these 2 incidents in Mother's room. Just because then the prosecutor points to one incident out of the 2 in closing, I don't necessarily know that remedies the problem with count 5. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.